The Bontang, a relative of the aurochs of Southeast Asia, still confined as a domestic animal to that area. 14. Mithon, wild ancestor, the gaur, another relative of the aurochs of India and Burma, still confined as a domestic animal to that area. The importance of domesticated mammals rests on surprisingly few species of big terrestrial herbivores. Only terrestrial mammals have been domesticated, for the obvious reason that aquatic mammals were difficult to maintain and breed until the development of modern SeaWorld facilities. If one defines big as weighing over 100 pounds, then only 14 such species were domesticated before the 20th century. Of those ancient 14, 9 became important livestock for people in only limited areas of the globe. The Arabian camel, Bactrian camel, llama, alpaca, distinct breeds of the same ancestral species, donkey, reindeer, water buffalo, yak, bontang, and gaur. Only 5 species became widespread and important around the world. Those major 5 of mammal domestication are the cow, sheep, goat, pig, and horse. This list may at first seem to have glaring omissions. What about the African elephants with which Hannibal's armies crossed the Alps? What about the Asian elephants still used as work animals in Southeast Asia today? No, I didn't forget them, and that raises an important distinction. Elephants have been tamed, but never domesticated. Hannibal's elephants were, and Asian work elephants are, just wild elephants that were captured and tamed. They were not bred in captivity. In contrast, a domesticated animal is defined as an animal selectively bred in captivity and thereby modified from its wild ancestors for use by humans who control the animal's breeding and food supply. That is, domestication involves wild animals being transformed into something more useful to humans. Truly domesticated animals differ in various ways from their wild ancestors. These differences result from 2 processes. Human selection of those individual animals more useful to humans than other individuals of the same species, and automatic evolutionary responses of animals to the altered forces of natural selection operating in human environments as compared with wild environments. We already saw in Chapter 7 that all of these statements also apply to plant domestication. The ways in which domesticated animals have diverged from their wild ancestors include the following. Many species changed in size. Cows, pigs, and sheep became smaller under domestication, while guinea pigs became larger. Sheep and alpacas were selected for retention of wool and reduction or loss of hair, while cows have been selected for high milk yields. Several species of domestic animals have smaller brains and less developed sense organs than their wild ancestors because they no longer need the bigger brains and more developed sense organs on which their ancestors depended to escape from wild predators. To appreciate the changes that developed under domestication, just compare wolves, the wild ancestors of domestic dogs, with the many breeds of dogs. Some dogs are much bigger than wolves, Great Danes, while others are much smaller, Pekingese. Some are slimmer and built for racing, greyhounds, while others are short-legged and useless for racing, Dachshunds. They vary enormously in their hair form and color, and some are even hairless. Polynesians and Aztecs developed dog breeds specifically raised for food. Compare a Dachshund with a wolf. You wouldn't even suspect that the former had been derived from the latter if you didn't already know it. The wild ancestors of the ancient 14 were spread unevenly over the globe. South America had only one such ancestor, which gave rise to the llama and alpaca. North America, Australia, and sub-Saharan Africa had none at all. The lack of domestic mammals indigenous to sub-Saharan Africa is especially astonishing, since a main reason why tourists visit Africa today is to see its abundant and diverse wild mammals. In contrast, the wild ancestors of 13 of the ancient 14, including all of the major 5, were confined to Eurasia. As elsewhere in this book, my use of the term Eurasia includes in several cases North Africa, which biogeographically and in many aspects of human culture is more closely related to Eurasia than to sub-Saharan Africa. Of course, not all 13 of these wild ancestral species occurred together throughout Eurasia. No area had all 13, and some of the wild ancestors were quite local. such as the yak, confined in the wild to Tibet and adjacent highland areas. However, many parts of Eurasia did have quite a few of these 13 species living together in the same area. For example, 7 of the wild ancestors occurred in Southwest Asia. This very unequal distribution of wild ancestral species among the continents became an important reason why Eurasians, rather than peoples of other continents, were the ones to end up with guns, germs, and steel. How can we explain the concentration of the ancient 14 in Eurasia? One reason is simple. Eurasia has the largest number of big terrestrial wild mammal species, whether or not ancestral to a domesticated species. Let's define a candidate for domestication as any terrestrial, herbivorous, or omnivorous mammal species, one not predominantly a carnivore, weighing on the average over 100 pounds. Eurasia has the most candidates, 72 species, just as it has the most species in many other plant and animal groups. That's because Eurasia is the world's largest landmass, and it's also very diverse ecologically, with habitats ranging from extensive tropical rainforests through temperate forests, deserts, and marshes to equally extensive tundras. Sub-Saharan Africa has fewer candidates, 51 species, just as it has fewer species in most other plant and animal groups because it's smaller and ecologically less diverse than Eurasia. Africa has smaller areas of tropical rainforest than does Southeast Asia and no temperate habitats at all beyond latitude 37 degrees. As I discussed in Chapter 1, the Americas may formerly have had almost as many candidates as Africa, but most of America's big wild mammals, including its horses, most of its camels, and other species likely to have been domesticated had they survived, became extinct about 13,000 years ago. Australia, the smallest and most isolated continent, has always had far fewer species of big wild mammals than has Eurasia, Africa, or the Americas. Just as in the Americas, in Australia, all of those few candidates except the red kangaroo became extinct around the time of the continent's first colonization by humans. Thus, part of the explanation for Eurasia's having been the main site of big mammal domestication is that it was the continent with the most candidate species of wild mammals to start out with, and lost the fewest candidates to extinction in the last 40,000 years. But the numbers warn us that that's not the whole explanation. It's also true that the percentage of candidates actually domesticated is highest in Eurasia, 18%, and is especially low in sub-Saharan Africa, no species domesticated out of 51 candidates. Particularly surprising is the large number of species of African and American mammals that were never domesticated, despite their having Eurasian close relatives or counterparts that were domesticated. Why were Eurasia's horses domesticated, but not Africa's zebras? Why Eurasia's pigs, but not American peccaries, or Africa's three species of true wild pigs? Why Eurasia's five species of wild cattle, aurochs, water buffalo, yak, gaur, banteng, but not the African buffalo or American bison? Why the Asian mouflon sheep, ancestor of our domestic sheep, but not North American bighorn sheep? Did all those peoples of Africa, the Americas, and Australia, despite their enormous diversity, nonetheless share some cultural obstacles to domestication not shared with Eurasian peoples? For example, did Africa's abundance of big wild mammals, available to kill by hunting, make it superfluous for Africans to go to the trouble of tending domestic stock? The answer to that question is unequivocal. No. The interpretation is refuted by five types of evidence. Rapid acceptance of Eurasian domesticates by non-Eurasian peoples. The universal human penchant for keeping pets. The rapid domestication of the ancient 14. The repeated independent domestications of some of them. And the limited successes of modern efforts at further domestications. First, when Eurasia's major five domestic mammals reached sub-Saharan Africa, they were adopted by the most diverse African peoples wherever conditions permitted. Those African herders thereby achieved a huge advantage over African hunter-gatherers and quickly displaced them. In particular, Bantu farmers who acquired cows and sheep spread out of their homeland in West Africa and within a short time overran the former hunter-gatherers in most of the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. Even without acquiring crops, Khoisan peoples, who acquired cows and sheep around 2,000 years ago, displaced Khoisan hunter-gatherers over much of southern Africa. The arrival of the domestic horse in West Africa transformed warfare there and turned the area into a set of kingdoms dependent on cavalry. The only factor that prevented horses from spreading beyond West Africa was trypanosome diseases borne by tsetse flies. The same pattern repeated itself elsewhere in the world. Whenever peoples lacking native wild mammal species suitable for domestication finally had the opportunity to acquire Eurasian domestic animals. European horses were eagerly adopted by Native Americans in both North and South America, within a generation of the escape of horses from European settlements. For example, by the 19th century, North America's Great Plains Indians were famous as expert horse-mounted warriors and bison hunters, but they did not even obtain horses until the late 17th century. Sheep acquired from Spaniards similarly transformed Navajo Indian society and led to, among other things, the weaving of the beautiful woolen blankets for which the Navajo have become renowned. Within a decade of Tasmania's settlement by Europeans with dogs, Aboriginal Tasmanians, who had never before seen dogs, began to breed them in large numbers for use in hunting. Thus, among the thousands of culturally diverse native peoples of Australia, the Americas, and Africa, no universal cultural taboo stood in the way of animal domestication. Surely if some local wild mammal species of those continents had been domesticable, some Australian, American, and African peoples would have domesticated them and gained great advantage from them, just as they benefited from the Eurasian domestic animals that they immediately adopted when those became available. For instance, consider all the peoples of sub-Saharan Africa living within the range of wild zebras and buffalo. Why wasn't there at least one African hunter-gatherer tribe that domesticated those zebras and buffalo, and that thereby gained sway over other Africans, without having to await the arrival of Eurasian horses and cattle? All these facts indicate that the explanation for the lack of native mammal domestication outside Eurasia lay with the locally available wild mammals themselves, not with the local peoples. A second type of evidence for the same interpretation comes from pets. Keeping wild animals as pets and taming them constitute an initial stage in domestication. But pets have been reported from virtually all traditional human societies on all continents. The variety of wild animals thus tamed is far greater than the variety eventually domesticated, and includes some species that we would scarcely have imagined as pets. For example, in the New Guinea village where I work, I often see people with pet kangaroos, possums, and birds ranging from flycatchers to ospreys. Most of these captives are eventually eaten, though some are kept just as pets. New Guineans even regularly capture chicks of wild cassowaries, an ostrich-like large flightless bird, and raise them to eat as a delicacy. Even though captive adult cassowaries are extremely dangerous and now and then disembowel village people. Some Asian peoples tame eagles for use in hunting, although those powerful pets have also been known on occasion to kill their human handlers. Ancient Egyptians and Assyrians and modern Indians tamed cheetahs for use in hunting. Paintings made by ancient Egyptians show that they further tamed, not surprisingly, hoofed mammals such as gazelles and hartebeests, birds such as cranes, more surprisingly, giraffes, which can be dangerous, and most astonishingly, hyenas. African elephants were tamed in Roman times despite the obvious danger, and Asian elephants are still being tamed today. Perhaps the most unlikely pet is the European brown bear, the same species as the American grizzly bear, which the Ainu people of Japan regularly captured as young animals, tamed and reared to kill and eat in a ritual ceremony. Thus, many wild animal species reached the first stage in the sequence of animal-human relations leading to domestication, but only a few emerged at the other end of that sequence as domestic animals. Over a century ago, the British scientist Francis Galton summarized this discrepancy succinctly. Quote, "It would appear that every wild animal has had its chance of being domesticated, that a few were domesticated long ago, but that the large remainder who failed sometimes in only one small particular are destined to perpetual wildness." End quote. Dates of domestication provide a third line of evidence confirming Galton's view that early herding peoples quickly domesticated all big mammal species suitable for being domesticated. All species for whose dates of domestication we have archaeological evidence were domesticated between about 8,000 and 2,500 BC, that is, within the first few thousand years of the sedentary farming herding societies that arose after the end of the last ice age. The era of big mammal domestication began with the sheep, goat, and pig, and ended with camels. Since 2500 BC, there have been no significant additions. It's true, of course, that some small mammals were first domesticated long after 2500 BC. For example, rabbits were not domesticated for food until the Middle Ages. Mice and rats for laboratory research not until the 20th century. And hamsters for pets not until the 1930s. The continuing development of domesticated small mammals isn't surprising, because there are literally thousands of wild species as candidates, and because they were of too little value to traditional societies to warrant the effort of raising them. But big mammal domestication virtually ended 4,500 years ago. By then, all of the world's 148 candidate big species must have been tested innumerable times, with the result that only a few passed the test, and no other suitable ones remained. Still a fourth line of evidence that some mammal species are much more suitable than others is provided by the repeated independent domestications of the same species. Genetic evidence based on the portions of our genetic material known as mitochondrial DNA recently confirmed, as had long been suspected, that humped cattle of India and humpless European cattle were derived from two separate populations of wild ancestral cattle that had diverged hundreds of thousands of years ago. That is, Indian peoples domesticated the local Indian subspecies of wild aurochs. Southwest Asians independently domesticated their own Southwest Asian subspecies of aurochs. And North Africans may have independently domesticated the North African aurochs. Similarly, wolves were independently domesticated to become dogs in the Americas, and probably in several different parts of Eurasia, including China and Southwest Asia. Modern pigs are derived from independent sequences of domestication in China, Western Eurasia, and possibly other areas as well. These examples re-emphasize that the same few suitable wild species attracted the attention of many different human societies. The failures of modern efforts provide a final type of evidence that past failures to domesticate the large residue of wild candidate species arose from shortcomings of those species, rather than from shortcomings of ancient humans. Europeans today are heirs to one of the longest traditions of animal domestication on Earth, that which began in Southwest Asia around 10,000 years ago. Since the 15th century, Europeans have spread around the globe and encountered wild mammal species not found in Europe. European settlers, such as those that I encounter in New Guinea with pet kangaroos and possums, have tamed or made pets of many local mammals, just as have indigenous peoples. European herders and farmers emigrating to other continents have also made serious efforts to domesticate some local species. In the 19th and 20th centuries, at least six large mammals, the eland, elk, moose, musk ox, zebra, and American bison, have been the subjects of especially well-organized projects aimed at domestication, carried out by modern scientific animal breeders and geneticists. For example, eland, the largest African antelope, have been undergoing selection for meat quality and milk quantity in the Askania Nova Zoological Park in the Ukraine, as well as in England, Kenya, Zimbabwe, and South Africa. An experimental farm for elk, red deer in British terminology, has been operated by the Rowett Research Institute at Aberdeen, Scotland, and an experimental farm for moose has operated in the Pechero-Ilyich National Park in Russia. Yet these modern efforts have achieved only very limited successes. While bison meat occasionally appears in some U.S. supermarkets, and while moose have been ridden, milked, and used to pull sleds in Sweden and Russia, none of these efforts has yielded a result of sufficient economic value to attract many ranchers. It is especially striking that recent attempts to domesticate eland within Africa itself, where its disease resistance and climate tolerance would give it a big advantage over introduced Eurasian wild stock susceptible to African diseases, have not caught on. Thus, neither indigenous herders with access to candidate species over thousands of years, nor modern geneticists, have succeeded in making useful domesticates of large mammals beyond the ancient 14, which were domesticated by at least 4,500 years ago. Yet scientists today could undoubtedly, if they wished, fulfill for many species that part of the definition of domestication that specifies the control of breeding and food supply. For example, the San Diego and Los Angeles zoos are now subjecting the last surviving California condors to a more draconian control of breeding than that imposed upon any domesticated species. All individual condors have been genetically identified, and a computer program determines which male shall mate with which female in order to achieve human goals, in this case, to maximize genetic diversity and thereby preserve the endangered bird. Zoos are conducting similar breeding programs for many other threatened species, including gorillas and rhinos. But the zoo's rigorous selection of California condors shows no prospects of yielding an economically useful product. Nor do zoos' efforts with rhinos, although rhinos offer up to over 3 tons of meat on the hoof. As we shall now see, rhinos and most other big mammals present insuperable obstacles to domestication. In all, of the world's 148 big wild terrestrial herbivorous mammals, the candidates for domestication, only 14 pass the test. Why did the other 134 species fail? To which conditions was Francis Galton referring when he spoke of those other species as destined to perpetual wildness? The answer follows from the Anna Karenina principle. To be domesticated, a candidate wild species must possess many different characteristics. Lack of any single required characteristic dooms efforts at domestication just as it dooms efforts at building a happy marriage. Playing marriage counselor to the zebra-human couple and other ill-sorted pairs, we can recognize at least 6 groups of reasons for failed domestication. Diet. Every time that an animal eats a plant or another animal, the conversion of food biomass into the consumer's biomass involves an efficiency of much less than 100%, typically around 10%. That is, it takes around 10,000 pounds of corn to grow a 1,000-pound cow. If instead you want to grow 1,000 pounds of carnivore, you have to feed it 10,000 pounds of herbivore grown on 100,000 pounds of corn. Even among herbivores and omnivores, many species, like koalas, are too finicky in their plant preferences to recommend themselves as farm animals. As a result of this fundamental inefficiency, no mammalian carnivore has ever been domesticated for food. No, it's not because its meat would be tough or tasteless. We eat carnivorous wild fish all the time, and I can personally attest to the delicious flavor of lion burger. The nearest thing to an exception is the dog. Originally domesticated as a sentinel and hunting companion, but breeds of dogs were developed and raised for food in Aztec Mexico, Polynesia, and ancient China. However, regular dog eating has been a last resort of meat-deprived human societies. The Aztecs had no other domestic mammal, and the Polynesians and ancient Chinese had only pigs and dogs. Human societies blessed with domestic herbivorous mammals have not bothered to eat dogs, except as an uncommon delicacy, as in parts of Southeast Asia today. In addition, dogs are not strict carnivores, but omnivores. If you are so naive as to think that your beloved pet is really a meat eater, just read the list of ingredients on your bag of dog food. The dogs that the Aztecs and Polynesians reared for food were efficiently fattened on vegetables and garbage. Growth rate. To be worth keeping, domesticates must also grow quickly. That eliminates gorillas and elephants, even though they are vegetarians with admirably non-finicky food preferences and represent a lot of meat. What would-be gorilla or elephant rancher would wait 15 years for his herd to reach adult size? Modern Asians who want work elephants find it much cheaper to capture them in the wild and tame them. Problems of captive breeding. We humans don't like to have sex under the watchful eyes of others. Some potentially valuable animal species don't like to either. That's what derailed attempts to domesticate cheetahs, the swiftest of all land animals, despite our strong motivation to do so for thousands of years. As I already mentioned, tame cheetahs were prized by ancient Egyptians and Assyrians and modern Indians as hunting animals, infinitely superior to dogs. One Mughal emperor of India kept a stable of 1,000 cheetahs. But despite those large investments that many wealthy princes made, all of their cheetahs were tamed ones caught in the wild. The prince's efforts to breed cheetahs in captivity failed, and not until 1960 did even biologists in modern zoos achieve their first successful cheetah birth. In the wild, several cheetah brothers chase a female for several days, and that rough courtship over large distances seems to be required to get the female to ovulate or to become sexually receptive. Cheetahs usually refuse to carry out that elaborate courtship ritual inside a cage. A similar problem has frustrated schemes to breed the vicuña, an Andean wild camel whose wool is prized as the finest and lightest of any animals. The ancient Incas obtained vicuña wool by driving wild vicuñas into corrals, shearing them, and then releasing them alive. Modern merchants wanting this luxury wool have had to resort either to this same method or simply to killing wild vicuñas. Despite strong incentives of money and prestige, all attempts to breed vicuñas for wool production in captivity have failed, for reasons that include vicuñas' long and elaborate courtship ritual before mating, a ritual inhibited in captivity, male vicuñas' fierce intolerance of each other, and their requirement for both a year-round feeding territory and a separate year-round sleeping territory. Nasty disposition. Naturally, almost any mammal species that is sufficiently large is capable of killing a human. People have been killed by pigs, horses, camels, and cattle. Nevertheless, some large animals have much nastier dispositions and are more incurably dangerous than are others. Tendencies to kill humans have disqualified many otherwise seemingly ideal candidates for domestication. One obvious example is the grizzly bear. Bear meat is an expensive delicacy. Grizzlies weigh up to 1,700 pounds. They are mainly vegetarians, though also formidable hunters. Their vegetable diet is very broad. They thrive on human garbage, thereby creating big problems in Yellowstone and Glacier National Parks. And they grow relatively fast. If they would behave themselves in captivity, grizzlies would be a fabulous meat production animal. The Ainu people of Japan made the experiment by routinely rearing grizzly cubs as part of a ritual. For understandable reasons, though, the Ainu found it prudent to kill and eat the cubs at the age of 1 year. Keeping grizzly bears for longer would be suicidal. I am not aware of any adult that has been tamed. Another otherwise suitable candidate that disqualifies itself for equally obvious reasons is the African buffalo. It grows quickly up to a weight of a ton and lives in herds that have a well-developed dominance hierarchy, a trait whose virtues will be discussed below. But the African buffalo is considered the most dangerous and unpredictable large mammal of Africa. Anyone insane enough to try to domesticate it either died in the effort or was forced to kill the buffalo before it got too big and nasty. Similarly, hippos, as 4-ton vegetarians, would be great barnyard animals if they weren't so dangerous. They kill more people each year than do any other African mammals, including even lions. Few people would be surprised at the disqualification of those notoriously ferocious candidates, but there are other candidates whose dangers are not so well known. For instance, the 8 species of wild equids, horses and their relatives, vary greatly in disposition, even though all 8 are genetically so close to each other that they will interbreed and produce healthy, though usually sterile, offspring. 2 of them, the horse and the North African ass, ancestor of the donkey, were successfully domesticated. Closely related to the North African ass is the Asiatic ass, also known as the onager. Since its homeland includes the Fertile Crescent, the cradle of Western civilization and animal domestication, ancient peoples must have experimented extensively with onagers. We know from Sumerian and later depictions that onagers were regularly hunted, as well as captured and hybridized with donkeys and horses. Some ancient depictions of horse-like animals used for riding or for pulling carts may refer to onagers. However, all writers about them, from Romans to modern zookeepers, decry their irascible temper and their nasty habit of biting people. As a result, although similar in other respects to ancestral donkeys, onagers have never been domesticated. Africa's 4 species of zebras are even worse. Efforts at domestication went as far as hitching them to carts. They were tried out as draft animals in 19th century South Africa. and the eccentric Lord Walter Rothschild drove through the streets of London in a carriage pulled by zebras. Alas, zebras become impossibly dangerous as they grow older. That's not to deny that many individual horses are also nasty, but zebras and onagers are much more uniformly so. Zebras have the unpleasant habit of biting a person and not letting go. They thereby injure even more American zookeepers each year than do tigers. Zebras are also virtually impossible to lasso with a rope, even for cowboys who win rodeo championships by lassoing horses, because of their unfailing ability to watch the rope noose fly toward them and then to duck their head out of the way. Hence it has rarely, if ever, been possible to saddle or ride a zebra, and South Africans' enthusiasm for their domestication waned. Unpredictably aggressive behavior on the part of a large and potentially dangerous mammal is also part of the reason why the initially so promising modern experiments in domesticating elk and eland have not been more successful. Tendency to panic. Big mammalian herbivore species react to danger from predators or humans in different ways. Some species are nervous, fast, and programmed for instant flight when they perceive a threat. Other species are slower, less nervous, seek protection in herds, stand their ground when threatened, and don't run until necessary. Most species of deer and antelope, with the conspicuous exception of reindeer, are of the former type, while sheep and goats are of the latter. Naturally, the nervous species are difficult to keep in captivity. If put into an enclosure, they are likely to panic and either die of shock or batter themselves to death against the fence in their attempts to escape. That's true, for example, of gazelles, which for thousands of years were the most frequently hunted game species in some parts of the Fertile Crescent. There is no mammal species that the first settled peoples of that area had more opportunity to domesticate than gazelles. But no gazelle species has ever been domesticated. Just imagine trying to herd an animal that bolts, blindly bashes itself against walls, can leap up to nearly 30 feet, and can run at a speed of 50 miles per hour. Social structure. Almost all species of domesticated large mammals prove to be ones whose wild ancestors share three social characteristics. They live in herds, they maintain a well-developed dominance hierarchy among herd members, and the herds occupy overlapping home ranges rather than mutually exclusive territories. For example, herds of wild horses consist of one stallion, up to a half a dozen mares, and their foals. Mare A is dominant over mares B, C, D, and E. Mare B is submissive to A, but dominant over C, D, and E. C is submissive to B and A, but dominant over D and E, and so on. When the herd is on the move, its members maintain a stereotyped order. In the rear, the stallion. In the front, the top-ranking female, followed by her foals in order of age, with the youngest first. And behind her, the other mares in order of rank, each followed by her foals in order of age. In that way, many adults can coexist in the herd without constant fighting and with each knowing its rank. That social structure is ideal for domestication because humans, in effect, take over the dominance hierarchy. Domestic horses of a pack line follow the human leader as they would normally follow the top-ranking female. Herds or packs of sheep, goats, cows, and ancestral dogs, wolves, have a similar hierarchy. As young animals grow up in such a herd, they imprint on the animals that they regularly see nearby. Under wild conditions, those are members of their own species, but captive young herd animals also see humans nearby and imprint on humans as well. Such social animals lend themselves to herding. Since they are tolerant of each other, they can be bunched up. Since they instinctively follow a dominant leader and will imprint on humans as that leader, they can readily be driven by a shepherd or sheepdog. Herd animals do well when penned in crowded conditions because they are accustomed to living in densely packed groups in the wild. In contrast, members of most solitary territorial animal species cannot be herded. They do not tolerate each other, they do not imprint on humans, and they are not instinctively submissive. Whoever saw a line of cats, solitary and territorial in the wild, following a human or allowing themselves to be herded by a human? Every cat lover knows that cats are not submissive to humans in the way dogs instinctively are. Cats and ferrets are the sole territorial mammal species that were domesticated, because our motive for doing so was not to herd them in large groups, raised for food, but to keep them as solitary hunters or pets. While most solitary territorial species thus haven't been domesticated, it's not conversely the case that most herd species can be domesticated. Most can't, for one of several additional reasons. First, herds of many species don't have overlapping home ranges, but instead maintain exclusive territories against other herds. It's no more possible to pen two such herds together than to pen two males of a solitary species. Second, many species that live in herds for part of the year are territorial in the breeding season, when they fight and do not tolerate each other's presence. That's true of most deer and antelope species, again with the exception of reindeer, and it's one of the main factors that has disqualified all the social antelope species for which Africa is famous from being domesticated. While one's first association to African antelope is vast, dense herds spreading across the horizon, in fact, the males of those herds space themselves into territories and fight fiercely with each other when breeding. Hence, those antelope cannot be maintained in crowded enclosures in captivity, as can sheep or goats or cattle. Territorial behavior similarly combines with a fierce disposition and a slow growth rate to banish rhinos from the farmyard. Finally, many herd species, including again most deer and antelope, do not have a well-defined dominance hierarchy and are not instinctively prepared to become imprinted on a dominant leader, hence to become misimprinted on humans. As a result, though many deer and antelope species have been tamed, think of all those true Bambi stories, one never sees such tamed deer and antelope driven in herds like sheep. That problem also derailed domestication of North American bighorn sheep, which belong to the same genus as Asiatic mouflon sheep, ancestor of our domestic sheep. Bighorn sheep are suitable to us, and similar to mouflons in most respects, except a crucial one. They lack the mouflon's stereotypical behavior, whereby some individuals behave submissively toward other individuals whose dominance they acknowledge. Let's now return to the problem I posed at the outset of this chapter. Initially, one of the most puzzling features of animal domestication is the seeming arbitrariness with which some species have been domesticated while their close relatives have not. It turns out that all but a few candidates for domestication have been eliminated by the Anna Karenina principle. Humans and most animal species make an unhappy marriage for one or more of many possible reasons. The animal's diet, growth rate, mating habits, disposition, tendency to panic, and several distinct features of social organization. Only a small percentage of wild mammal species ended up in happy marriages with humans, by virtue of compatibility on all those separate counts. Eurasian peoples happen to inherit many more species of domesticable large wild mammalian herbivores than did peoples of the other continents. That outcome, with all of its momentous advantages for Eurasian societies, stemmed from three basic facts of mammalian geography, history, and biology. First, Eurasia, befitting its large area and ecological diversity, started out with the most candidates. Second, Australia and the Americas, but not Eurasia or Africa, lost most of their candidates in a massive wave of late Pleistocene extinctions, possibly because the mammals of the former continents had the misfortune to be first exposed to humans suddenly and late in our evolutionary history, when our hunting skills were already highly developed. Finally, a higher percentage of the surviving candidates proved suitable for domestication on Eurasia than on the other continents. An examination of the candidates that were never domesticated, such as Africa's big herd-forming mammals, reveals particular reasons that disqualified each of them. Thus, Tolstoy would have approved of the insight offered in another context by an earlier author, St. Matthew. Many are called, but few are chosen. Chapter 10, Spacious Skies and Tilted Axes. On a map of the world, compare the shapes and orientations of the continents. You'll be struck by an obvious difference. The Americas span a much greater distance north-south, 9,000 miles, than east-west, only 3,000 miles at the widest, narrowing to a mere 40 miles at the Isthmus of Panama. That is, the major axis of the Americas is north-south. The same is also true, though to a less extreme degree, for Africa. In contrast, the major axis of Eurasia is east-west. What effect, if any, did those differences in the orientation of the continent's axes have on human history? This chapter will be about what I see as their enormous, sometimes tragic, consequences. Axis orientations affected the rate of spread of crops and livestock, and possibly also of writing, wheels, and other inventions. That basic feature of geography thereby contributed heavily to the very different experiences of Native Americans, Africans, and Eurasians in the last 500 years. Food production spread proves as crucial to understanding geographic differences in the rise of guns, germs, and steel as did its origins, which we considered in the preceding chapters. That's because, as we saw in Chapter 5, there were no more than 9 areas of the globe, perhaps as few as 5, where food production arose independently. Yet, already in prehistoric times, food production became established in many other regions besides those few areas of origins. All those other areas became food-producing as a result of the spread of crops, livestock, and knowledge of how to grow them, and, in some cases, as a result of migrations of farmers and herders themselves. The main such spreads of food production were from Southwest Asia to Europe, Egypt, and North Africa, Ethiopia, Central Asia, and the Indus Valley. From the Sahel and West Africa to East and South Africa, from China to tropical Southeast Asia, the Philippines, Indonesia, Korea, and Japan, and from Mesoamerica to North America. Moreover, food production, even in its areas of origin, became enriched by the addition of crops, livestock, and techniques from other areas of origin. Just as some regions proved much more suitable than others for the origins of food production, the ease of its spread also varied greatly around the world. Some areas that are ecologically very suitable for food production never acquired it in prehistoric times at all, even though areas of prehistoric food production existed nearby. The most conspicuous such examples are the failure of both farming and herding to reach Native American California from the U.S. Southwest, or to reach Australia from New Guinea and Indonesia, and the failure of farming to spread from South Africa's natal province to South Africa's Cape. Even among all those areas where food production did spread in the prehistoric era, the rates and dates of spread varied considerably. At the one extreme was its rapid spread along east-west axes, from Southwest Asia, both west to Europe and Egypt, and east to the Indus Valley at an average rate of about 0.7 miles per year, and from the Philippines east to Polynesia at 3.2 miles per year. At the opposite extreme was its slow spread along north-south axes, at less than 0.5 miles per year from Mexico northward to the U.S. southwest, at less than 0.3 miles per year for corn and beans from Mexico northward to become productive in the eastern United States around AD 900, and at 0.2 miles per year for the llama from Peru north to Ecuador. These differences could be even greater if corn was not domesticated in Mexico as late as 3500 BC, as I assumed conservatively for these calculations, and, as some archaeologists now assume, but if it was instead domesticated considerably earlier, as most archaeologists used to assume, and many still do. There were also great differences in the completeness with which suites of crops and livestock spread, again implying stronger or weaker barriers to their spreading. For instance, while most of Southwest Asia's founder crops and livestock did spread west to Europe and east to the Indus Valley, neither of the Andes domestic mammals, the llama, alpaca, and the guinea pig, ever reached Mesoamerica in pre-Columbian times. That astonishing failure cries out for explanation. After all, Mesoamerica did develop dense farming populations and complex societies, so there can be no doubt that Andean domestic animals, if they had been available, would have been valuable for food, transport, and wool. Except for dogs, Mesoamerica was utterly without indigenous mammals to fill those needs. Some South American crops, nevertheless, did succeed in reaching Mesoamerica, such as manioc, sweet potatoes, and peanuts. What selective barrier let those crops through but screened out llamas and guinea pigs? A subtler expression of this geographically varying ease of spread is the phenomenon termed preemptive domestication. Most of the wild plant species from which our crops were derived vary genetically from area to area because alternative mutations had become established among the wild ancestral populations of different areas. Similarly, the changes required to transform wild plants into crops can in principle be brought about by alternative new mutations or alternative courses of selection to yield equivalent results. In this light, one can examine a crop widespread in prehistoric times and ask whether all of its varieties show the same wild mutation or same transforming mutation. The purpose of this examination is to try to figure out whether the crop was developed in just one area or else independently in several areas. If one carries out such a genetic analysis for major ancient New World crops, many of them prove to include two or more of those alternative wild variants, or two or more of those alternative transforming mutations. This suggests that the crop was domesticated independently in at least two different areas, and that some varieties of the crop inherited the particular mutation of one area, while other varieties of the same crop inherited the mutation of another area. On this basis, botanists conclude that lima beans, Phasaelus lonatus, common beans, Phasaelus vulgaris, and chili peppers of the Capsicum annuum, Chinense group, were all domesticated on at least two separate occasions, once in Mesoamerica and once in South America, and that the squash Cucurbita pepo and the seed plant goosefoot were also domesticated independently at least twice, once in Mesoamerica and once in the eastern United States. In contrast, most ancient Southwest Asian crops exhibit just one of the alternative wild variants or alternative transforming mutations, suggesting that all modern varieties of that particular crop stem from only a single domestication. What does it imply if the same crop has been repeatedly and independently domesticated in several different parts of its wild range, and not just once and in a single area? We have already seen that plant domestication involves the modification of plants so that they become more useful to humans by virtue of larger seeds, a less bitter taste, or other qualities. Hence, if a productive crop is already available, incipient farmers will surely proceed to grow it rather than start all over again by gathering its not-yet-so-useful wild relative and redomesticating it. Evidence for just a single domestication thus suggests that, once a wild plant had been domesticated, the crop spread quickly to other areas throughout the wild plant's range, preempting the need for other independent domestications of the same plant. However, when we find evidence that the same wild ancestor was domesticated independently in different areas, we infer that the crop spread too slowly to preempt its domestication elsewhere. The evidence for predominantly single domestications in Southwest Asia, but frequent multiple domestications in the Americas, might thus provide more subtle evidence that crops spread more easily out of Southwest Asia than in the Americas. Rapid spread of a crop may preempt domestication not only of the same wild ancestral species somewhere else, but also of related wild species. If you're already growing good peas, it's of course pointless to start from scratch to domesticate the same wild ancestral pea again, but it's also pointless to domesticate closely related wild pea species that for farmers are virtually equivalent to the already domesticated pea species. All of Southwest Asia's founder crops preempt the domestication of any of their close relatives throughout the whole expanse of Western Eurasia. In contrast, the New World presents many cases of equivalent and closely related, but nevertheless distinct species having been domesticated in Mesoamerica and South America. For instance, 95% of the cotton grown in the world today belongs to the cotton species Gossypium hirsutum, which was domesticated in prehistoric times in Mesoamerica. However, prehistoric South American farmers instead grew the related cotton Gossypium barbadense. Evidently, Mesoamerican cotton had such difficulty reaching South America that it failed in the prehistoric era to preempt the domestication of a different cotton species there, and vice versa. Chili peppers, squashes, amaranths, and quinopods are other crops of which different but related species were domesticated in Mesoamerica and South America, since no species was able to spread fast enough to preempt the others. We thus have many different phenomena converging on the same conclusion, that food production spread more readily out of Southwest Asia than in the Americas, and possibly also than in sub-Saharan Africa. Those phenomena include food production's complete failure to reach some ecologically suitable areas, the differences in its rate and selectivity of spread, and the differences in whether the earliest domesticated crops preempted redomestication of the same species or domestications of close relatives. What was it about the Americas and Africa that made the spread of food production more difficult there than in Eurasia? To answer this question, let's begin by examining the rapid spread of food production out of Southwest Asia, the Fertile Crescent. Soon after food production arose there, somewhat before 8000 BC, a centrifugal wave of it appeared in other parts of Western Eurasia and North Africa, farther and farther removed from the Fertile Crescent, to the west and east. Geneticist Donald Zohary and botanist Maria Hopf assembled a map in which they illustrate how the wave had reached Greece and Cyprus and the Indian subcontinent by 6500 BC, Egypt soon after 6000 BC, Central Europe by 5400 BC, southern Spain by 5200 BC, and Britain around 3500 BC. In each of those areas, food production was initiated by some of the same suite of domestic plants and animals that launched it in the Fertile Crescent. In addition, the Fertile Crescent package penetrated Africa southward to Ethiopia at some still uncertain date. However, Ethiopia also developed many indigenous crops, and we do not yet know whether it was these crops or the arriving Fertile Crescent crops that launched Ethiopian food production. Of course, not all pieces of the package spread to all those outlying areas. For example, Egypt was too warm for einkorn wheat to become established. In some outlying areas, elements of the package arrived at different times. For instance, sheep preceded cereals in southwestern Europe. Some outlying areas went on to domesticate a few local crops of their own, such as poppies in western Europe, and watermelons possibly in Egypt. But most food production in outlying areas depended initially on Fertile Crescent domesticates. Their spread was soon followed by that of other innovations originating in or near the Fertile Crescent, including the wheel, writing, metalworking techniques, milking, fruit trees, and beer and wine production. Why did the same plant package launch food production throughout Western Eurasia? Was it because the same set of plants occurred in the wild in many areas, were found useful there just as in the Fertile Crescent, and were independently domesticated? No, that's not the reason. First, many of the Fertile Crescent's founder crops don't even occur in the wild outside Southwest Asia. For instance, none of the eight main founder crops except barley grows wild in Egypt. Egypt's Nile Valley provides an environment similar to the Fertile Crescent's Tigris and Euphrates valleys. Hence, the package that worked well in the latter valleys also worked well enough in the Nile Valley to trigger the spectacular rise of indigenous Egyptian civilization. But the foods to fuel that spectacular rise were originally absent in Egypt. The Sphinx and pyramids were built by people fed on crops originally native to the Fertile Crescent, not to Egypt. Second, even for those crops whose wild ancestor does occur outside of Southwest Asia, we can be confident that the crops of Europe and India were mostly obtained from Southwest Asia and were not local domesticates. For example, wild flax occurs west to Britain and Algeria and east to the Caspian Sea, while wild barley occurs east even to Tibet. However, for most of the Fertile Crescent's founding crops, all cultivated varieties in the world today share only one arrangement of chromosomes out of the multiple arrangements found in the wild ancestor. Or else, they share only a single mutation, out of many possible mutations, by which the cultivated varieties differ from the wild ancestor in characteristics desirable to humans. For instance, all cultivated peas share the same recessive gene that prevents ripe pods of cultivated peas from spontaneously popping open and spilling their peas, as wild pea pods do. Evidently, most of the Fertile Crescent's founder crops were never domesticated again elsewhere, after their initial domestication in the Fertile Crescent. Had they been repeatedly domesticated independently, they would exhibit legacies of those multiple origins in the form of varied chromosomal arrangements or varied mutations. Hence, these are typical examples of the phenomenon of preemptive domestication that we discussed above. The quick spread of the Fertile Crescent package preempted any possible other attempts within the Fertile Crescent or elsewhere to domesticate the same wild ancestors. Once the crop had become available, there was no further need to gather it from the wild and thereby set it on the path to domestication again. The ancestors of most of the founder crops have wild relatives, in the Fertile Crescent and elsewhere, that would also have been suitable for domestication. For example, peas belong to the genus Pisum, which consists of two wild species. Pisum sativum, the one that became domesticated to yield our garden peas, and Pisum fulvum, which was never domesticated. Yet wild peas of Pisum fulvum taste good, either fresh or dried, and are common in the wild. Similarly, wheat, barley, lentil, chickpea, beans, and flax all have numerous wild relatives besides the ones that became domesticated. Some of those related beans and barleys were indeed domesticated independently in the Americas or China, far from the early site of domestication in the Fertile Crescent. But in Western Eurasia, only one of several potentially useful wild species was domesticated, probably because that one spread so quickly that people soon stopped gathering the other wild relatives and ate only the crop. Again, as we discussed above, the crop's rapid spread preempted any possible further attempts to domesticate its relatives, as well as to re-domesticate its ancestor. Why was the spread of crops from the Fertile Crescent so rapid? The answer depends partly on that east-west axis of Eurasia with which I opened this chapter. Localities distributed east and west of each other at the same latitude share exactly the same day length and its seasonal variations. To a lesser degree, they also tend to share similar diseases, regimes of temperature and rainfall, and habitats or biomes, types of vegetation. For example, southern Italy, northern Iran, and Japan, all located at about the same latitude but lying successively 4,000 miles east or west of each other, are more similar to each other in climate than each is to a location lying even a mere 1,000 miles due south. On all the continents, the habitat type known as tropical rainforest is confined to within about 10 degrees latitude of the equator, while Mediterranean scrub habitats, such as California's chaparral and Europe's maquis, lie between about 30 and 40 degrees of latitude. But the germination, growth, and disease resistance of plants are adapted to precisely those features of climate. Seasonal changes of day length, temperature, and rainfall constitute signals that stimulate seeds to germinate, seedlings to grow, and mature plants to develop flowers, seeds, and fruit. Each plant population becomes genetically programmed through natural selection to respond appropriately to signals of the seasonal regime under which it has evolved. Those regimes vary greatly with latitude. For example, day length is constant throughout the year at the equator, but at temperate latitudes it increases as the months advance from the winter solstice to the summer solstice, and it then declines again through the next half of the year. The growing season, that is, the months with temperatures and day lengths suitable for plant growth, is shortest at high latitudes and longest toward the equator. Plants are also adapted to the diseases prevalent at their latitude. Woe betide the plant whose genetic program is mismatched to the latitude of the field in which it is planted. Imagine a Canadian farmer foolish enough to plant a race of corn adapted to growing farther south, in Mexico. The unfortunate corn plant, following its Mexico-adapted genetic program, would prepare to thrust up its shoots in March, only to find itself still buried under 10 feet of snow. Should the plant become genetically reprogrammed so as to germinate at a time more appropriate to Canada, say late June, the plant would still be in trouble for other reasons. Its genes would be telling it to grow at a leisurely rate, sufficient only to bring it to maturity in 5 months. That's a perfectly safe strategy in Mexico's mild climate, but in Canada, a disastrous one that would guarantee the plants being killed by autumn frosts before it had produced any mature corn cobs. The plant would also lack genes for resistance to diseases of northern climates, while uselessly carrying genes for resistance to diseases of southern climates. All those features make low-latitude plants poorly adapted to high-latitude conditions, and vice versa. As a consequence, most Fertile Crescent crops grow well in France and Japan, but poorly at the equator. Animals, too, are adapted to latitude-related features of climate. In that respect, we are typical animals, as we know by introspection. Some of us can't stand cold northern winters with their short days and characteristic germs, while others of us can't stand hot tropical climates with their own characteristic diseases. In recent centuries, overseas colonists from cool northern Europe have preferred to emigrate to the similarly cool climates of North America, Australia, and South Africa, and to settle in the cool highlands within equatorial Kenya and New Guinea. Northern Europeans who were sent out to hot tropical lowland areas used to die in droves of diseases such as malaria, to which tropical peoples had evolved some genetic resistance. That's part of the reason why Fertile Crescent domesticates spread west and east so rapidly. They were already well adapted to the climates of the region to which they were spreading. For instance, once farming crossed from the plains of Hungary into Central Europe around 5400 BC, it spread so quickly that the sites of the first farmers in the vast area from Poland west to Holland, marked by their characteristic pottery with linear decorations, were nearly contemporaneous. By the time of Christ, cereals of Fertile Crescent origin were growing over the 8,000-mile expanse from the Atlantic coast of Ireland to the Pacific coast of Japan. That west-east expansion of Eurasia is the largest land distance on Earth. Thus, Eurasia's west-east axis allowed Fertile Crescent crops quickly to launch agriculture over the band of temperate latitudes from Ireland to the Indus Valley, and to enrich the agriculture that arose independently in eastern Asia. Conversely, Eurasian crops that were first domesticated far from the Fertile Crescent, but at the same latitudes, were able to diffuse back to the Fertile Crescent. Today, when seeds are transported over the whole globe by ship and plane, we take it for granted that our meals are a geographic mishmash. A typical American fast food restaurant meal would include chicken, first domesticated in China, and potatoes from the Andes, or corn from Mexico, seasoned with black pepper from India, and washed down with a cup of coffee of Ethiopian origin. Already, though, by 2,000 years ago, Romans were also nourishing themselves with their own hodgepodge of foods that mostly originated elsewhere. Of Roman crops, only oats and poppies were native to Italy. Roman staples were the Fertile Crescent founder package, supplemented by quince, originating in the Caucasus, millet and cumin, domesticated in Central Asia, cucumber, sesame, and citrus fruit from India, and chicken, rice, apricots, peaches, and foxtail millet, originally from China. Even though Rome's apples were at least native to Western Eurasia, they were grown by means of grafting techniques that had developed in China and spread westward from there. While Eurasia provides the world's widest band of land at the same latitude, and hence the most dramatic example of rapid spread of domesticates, there are other examples as well. Rivaling in speed the spread of the Fertile Crescent package was the eastward spread of a subtropical package that was initially assembled in South China, and that received additions on reaching tropical Southeast Asia, the Philippines, Indonesia, and New Guinea. Within 1,600 years, that resulting package of crops, including bananas, taro, and yams, and domestic animals, chickens, pigs, and dogs, had spread more than 5,000 miles eastward into the tropical Pacific to reach the islands of Polynesia. A further likely example is the east-west spread of crops within Africa's wide Sahel zone, but paleobotanists have yet to work out the details. Contrast the ease of east-west diffusion in Eurasia with the difficulties of diffusion along Africa's north-south axis. Most of the Fertile Crescent founder crops reached Egypt very quickly and then spread as far south as the cool highlands of Ethiopia, beyond which they didn't spread. South Africa's Mediterranean climate would have been ideal for them, but the 2,000 miles of tropical conditions between Ethiopia and South Africa posed an insuperable barrier. Instead, African agriculture south of the Sahara was launched by the domestication of wild plants, such as sorghum and African yams, indigenous to the Sahel zone and to tropical West Africa, and adapted to the warm temperatures, summer rains, and relatively constant day lengths of those low latitudes. Similarly, the spread southward of Fertile Crescent domestic animals through Africa was stopped or slowed by climate and disease, especially by trypanosome diseases carried by tsetse flies. The horse never became established farther south in West Africa's kingdoms north of the equator. The advance of cattle, sheep, and goats halted for 2,000 years at the northern edge of the Serengeti Plains, while new types of human economies and livestock breeds were being developed. Not until the period AD 1 to 200, some 8,000 years after livestock were domesticated in the Fertile Crescent, did cattle, sheep, and goats finally reach South Africa. Tropical African crops had their own difficulties spreading south in Africa, arriving in South Africa with black African farmers, the Bantu, just after those Fertile Crescent livestock did. However, those tropical African crops could never be transmitted across South Africa's Fish River, beyond which they were stopped by Mediterranean conditions to which they were not adapted. The result was the all-too-familiar course of the last two millennia of South African history. Some of South Africa's indigenous Khoisan peoples, otherwise known as Hottentots and Bushmen, acquired livestock but remained without agriculture. They became outnumbered and were replaced northeast of the Fish River by black African farmers whose southward spread halted at that river. Only when European settlers arrived by sea in 1652, bringing with them their Fertile Crescent crop package, could agriculture thrive in South Africa's Mediterranean zone. The collisions of all those peoples produced the tragedies of modern South Africa. The quick decimation of the Khoisan by European germs and guns, a century of wars between Europeans and blacks, another century of racial oppression, and now efforts by Europeans and blacks to seek a new mode of coexistence in the former Khoisan lands. Contrast also the ease of diffusion in Eurasia with its difficulties along the Americas' north-south axis. The distance between Mesoamerica and South America, say between Mexico's highlands and Ecuador's, is only 1,200 miles, approximately the same distance as the distance in Eurasia separating the Balkans from Mesopotamia. The Balkans provided ideal growing conditions for most Mesopotamian crops and livestock, and received those domesticates as a package within 2,000 years of its assembly in the Fertile Crescent. That rapid spread preempted opportunities for domesticating those and related species in the Balkans. Highland Mexico and the Andes would similarly have been suitable for many of each other's crops and domestic animals. A few crops, notably Mexican corn, did indeed spread to the other region in the pre-Columbian era. But other crops and domestic animals failed to spread between Mesoamerica and South America. The cool highlands of Mexico would have provided ideal conditions for raising llamas, guinea pigs, and potatoes, all domesticated in the cool highlands of the South American Andes. Yet the northward spread of those Andean specialties was stopped completely by the hot intervening lowlands of Central America. 5,000 years after llamas had been domesticated in the Andes, the Olmecs, Maya, Aztecs, and all other native societies of Mexico remained without pack animals and without any edible domestic mammals except for dogs. Conversely, domestic turkeys of Mexico and domestic sunflowers of the eastern United States might have thrived in the Andes, but their southward spread was stopped by the intervening tropical climates. The mere 700 miles of north-south distance prevented Mexican corn, squash, and beans from reaching the U.S. Southwest for several thousand years after their domestication in Mexico. And Mexican chili peppers and quinopods never did reach it in prehistoric times. For thousands of years after corn was domesticated in Mexico, it failed to spread northward into eastern North America because of the cooler climates and shorter growing season prevailing there. At some time between AD 1 and AD 200, corn finally appeared in the eastern United States, but only as a very minor crop. Not until around AD 900, after hardy varieties of corn adapted to northern climates had been developed, could corn-based agriculture contribute to the flowering of the most complex Native American society of North America, the Mississippian culture, a brief flowering ended by European-introduced germs arriving with and after Columbus. Recall that most Fertile Crescent crops prove, upon genetic study, to derive from only a single domestication process, whose resulting crop spread so quickly that it preempted any other incipient domestications of the same or related species. In contrast, many apparently widespread Native American crops proved to consist of related species or even of genetically distinct varieties of the same species, independently domesticated in Mesoamerica, South America, and the eastern United States. Closely related species replace each other geographically among the amaranths, beans, quinopods, chili peppers, cottons, squashes, and tobaccos. Different varieties of the same species replace each other among the kidney beans, lima beans, the chili pepper Capsicum annuum chinense, and the squash Cucurbita pepo. Those legacies of multiple independent domestications may provide further testimony to the slow diffusion of crops along the America's north-south axis. Africa and